that we need to cover in this last lecture is a little bit more about interpretation. And we talked about these first three types of interpretation in the lecture I gave a little while ago, qualitative, parametric, and forward modelling. And I'm just going to talk about these other two types, and then I'm going to give you some examples. Okay, if there's one way in which I could say that the whole class would have done a little bit better on the essays that you recently handed in, it was to give specific examples. You know, a magnetic survey was done over prospect such and such, and such and such magnetometer was used, and this gave good results because of etc. So when you're writing your summer exam questions, you know, the key things you need to think of is draw figures, give examples, and named examples, and show evidence for reading outside the course. If you do those three things, then you know that's immediately several tens of percent marks that you've got in the bag. So I've just marked another essay that's got zero figures, and that student has immediately lost 15% for not including any figures. The person who got the highest mark in the magnetics essay had drawn lots of very beautiful figures. Okay, so inverse methods, let's talk about those first. What that involves is going out, doing your survey, having your data, plotting it up or whatever, and going from those data, maybe typing them into a computer and telling the computer to calculate what body has caused that magnetic field. And that's extremely difficult to do because, as I've said before, we've got this inverse problem. The magnetic field is dependent on many different things, and different combinations of these things can give you exactly the same body. So, you know, if you do a nice magnetic survey over a dike and you type that into the computer and say, tell me what kind of a dike has caused that anomaly, the computer's going to tell you which one of the 10,000 possible answers do you want. You might get some back talk from the computer. If the computer was not clever enough to realise that you were being stupid, the computer would just give you some answer and you might run away with that thinking that was right when it was completely wrong. So in order to do inverse modelling, you have to constrain some things. You could say to the computer, here's the susceptibility, here's the direction of magnetisation, here's the depth of the dike, tell me the width. And then that would be possible because, you're just asking for one thing. So reduce the number of variables. If you go out in the summer and you decide to do magnetic survey for your projects, then you need to find as much background information as you possibly can. If you're surveying over a dike, look at the geological map and see how wide that is. Go into the field, make some geological observations of your own to constrain that. Take a sample and look how strong the magnetization is, what direction it is, and so forth. And then you could find out those critical things that you don't know, such as the depth to it. Data enhancement is perhaps the way to go. This is the way that you generally go. Generally, what you would do if you were working for a company, you might be focusing on seismic data because they're very important, but your boss might say, take a look at the magnetics and see if it agrees with your interpretation. And what you would do, A, you would not be a specialist because it's not a very widely used method, and B, you've got all these problems. So what you would tend to do is qualitative assessment and data enhancement. That would be the most likely way in which you would carry that project forward. So you'd try displaying the data in different ways to see what you could see in the map. If you display them in different ways, then you can see different features. I showed you an example of this in gravity surveying with Long Valley. If you remember, there were many, many ways you could plot the first derivative, the second derivative, the maximum gradient of the second derivative, etc., etc. And you'll find that different things can pop up that you might not notice just looking at the plain old data. So these are various ways in which you can do it. If we take magnetic measurements here in England, things are a little bit complicated by the fact that the Earth's field is dipping at some angle, okay? The angle of inclination. It's not vertical, up or down. It's dipping at some angle. And this does cause anomalies to be not symmetric like this. But if you can calculate what the anomaly would look like if the Earth's field were directly downwards, pointing directly downwards, then things can simplify a bit. So here we have an example of a measurement which was taken at some particular angle, and then it was calculated what that anomaly would look like if the Earth's field was not at an angle but was directly pointing down. And this is called reduction to the pole because you've essentially got the field, you know, you've got a field over your ore body or whatever it is, as it would have looked if that body had been at the North Pole, the magnetic North Pole, that is. The magnetic pole for your compass needle would point directly downwards. So this can give you a simple, you know, something that looks a little bit simple, and it can help you to deduce what the body might be. Okay, another thing that you can do to manipulate your data is known as upward and downward continuation. And this is where you calculate what the field looks like at a different height. So I gave you an example of this when I said that you know, you could have gone out and you could have done a very modern, sophisticated survey in an area, but there's always older data available from the region round about, and you want to, you know, you might find some interesting anomaly, and you might think, well, maybe there are other such anomalies. Maybe I could use these older data to pick out regions that might also be interesting for me to go and target, you know, a careful survey. You know, and in which case you could use this technique if the older data had been taken at a high flying height or low flying height, you could calculate what your field would look like if it had been measured at that same height. And if you calculate what it looks like at a greater height, that's upward continuation. If you calculate it at lower height, that's downward continuation. Usually what's done is upward continuation, because if you downward continue, you're blowing up noise. So as I say, if there's some small anomaly or outlier or something like this in your data, if you downward continue, that's going to blow that up and make it look much more important than it actually is. So this is safe and this is dodgy. You can calculate what the gravity field would look like from the magnetic field. So to a first approximation, the strength of the magnetic field is related to the amount of magnetite in your body. So you could make the simplifying assumption that the density of the body is proportional to the magnetization. And if you do that, then you can calculate what the gravity field would look like over that body, and then you can use the many methods of gravity data analysis to analyze that gravity field. And that's known as pseudo-gravity. It's not very often used because usually it's not a valid assumption, but there could be some cases where it could be used. Again, you'd have to assess your own situation before you decided. So let's look at some examples, give you a flavour for what sort of thing is actually done. And I've picked out five for you here, which I hope cover the main kind of range of what's done. And the first one's from the Eastern Mediterranean, so just to orient you here, is the Holy Land, and this is the Eastern Med, and here we have Cyprus. You get to go on the Cyprus field trip this year. Or is that for 3rd years? Is it? Okay. I went on the Cyprus field trip once and nearly got mugged. Really rough area where students put up. Okay, so here is Egypt. And I must say that I'd got a second year undergraduate with me and he leapt to my defence. I was greatly impressed. So what we're looking at here is the Bugoy gravity map of this area. So we've got the Mediterranean, and see that gravity is relatively high there, so red is high gravity. And since you get on land, here we've got low gravity. And this is what the magnetic field looks like over here. So not exactly a one-to-one correspondence, but with the knowledge of the geology, it may high gravity over here. This doesn't stop at the coast, but it extends to the Dead Sea Rift. Right, so it comes part of this land area. So this suggests that the crust is thin under this area. Gravity is probably high in the Mediterranean because it's an extending area and the crust is thinned, so the higher density mantle material is close to the surface. And it looks as though this doesn't just cut off on the boundary of the land, but it extends inland. So, you know, here already you have an important piece of geological information. So the question is, can the magnetics add something to it? Well, the magnetics has been interpreted in this way, and this may or may not be correct. I can't say that it looks sort of blindingly convincing to me, but it's been interpreted that there are two lineations here. And it's been interpreted that this is a left lateral zone. Okay, so the idea is that this was once a continuous line, but in actual fact it's been motion like this. So it was suggested that the Dead Sea Rift is a left lateral zone. This lineament, as is drawn here, was also picked out of the data. So this may extend from the Cyprian arc and represent an ancient shear zone. I can't see any particular correlation with the gravity here. So this would, I guess you can see something here. Okay. Is it just me, or can you see something here as well? Can? Okay. So this is essentially what was done with this. It was just a question of looking at it and saying, "Oh, there looks as though there's a lineament there." Left lateral, what's it here? And then of course you can go to the geology and say, is there some evidence for that? Can we see some offsets? What rates do we think that's moving at? Shall we do some GPS measurements and test that? So, you know, you see what you're basically doing is getting some sort of fundamental feel for it, rather than some, you know, really fixed specific interpretation. Spreading ridges. Don't forget the good old plate tectonics. If you were to write an essay on that involved giving some examples, of course, the Vine-Matthews hypothesis. Does anybody know what the Vine-Matthews hypothesis is? Since you're terribly shy, I promise I won't pick on anybody. But raise your hand if you know what the Vine-Matthews hypothesis is. Okay, nobody knows. Well, Vine and Matthews, namely Vine, the PhD student, noticed that if you did a magnetic profile across the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, then you got a situation like this, where you had positive magnetization, then negative, and then positive and negative, and it was symmetric on both sides. So Vine came up with the idea, he wasn't first, but he got the credit for it, came up with the idea that the plates were moving away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and that as they did so, volcanic material came up and filled the gap that was made. And because the Earth's field is constantly reversing, then you'd get a positive band, then a negative band, and a positive band, and it was symmetric across the ridge. So the Vine-Matthews hypothesis is essentially seafloor spreading, and it was got from looking at magnetic profiles across the Reykjanes Ridge just south of Iceland. Don't forget that very important application if you're writing an essay on this subject. This is what it looked like. This is the region. Let me see, here we have Iceland, and this is the region that Vine and Matthews looked at. And there's a story that, first of all, a Canadian called Morley, he came up with this idea, and he submitted his paper to Nature and got it rejected. And a few months later, Vine, a PhD student, so the story goes, also came up with this idea. But it was such a kind of wild idea. You know, the idea is that the continent's moving. People just had a lot of trouble with that. And he thought this wouldn't be taken seriously by his supervisor, Matthews. So his supervisor was away at sea, and Vine wrote this up to submit to Nature, and he put Drummond Matthews' name on it because he thought that if nobody like him submitted this to Nature, it would just be rejected. But if you put a famous name on it, then the editors would take it seriously. And the story goes, I don't know if not that this paper was accepted and printed before Drummond Matthews came back from sea and knew anything about it. Propelled him into everlasting fame, even though he knew nothing of it, and he might very well have forbidden it if he'd been there. Who knows? Anyway, this is what the North Atlantic looks like. So people have, just to be helpful, have drawn these black lines. If they didn't draw the black lines, you might have trouble seeing these stripes because, you know, although we see these nice textbook pictures that look like a zebra crossing, black, white, that's not what the data actually look like. People were particularly interested in seeing whether these anomalies continued across this zone here. Here we have Iceland, we've got Greenland, and here we have the Faroe Islands and Britain. And between the Faroe Islands and Greenland, there's this ridge of thick crust here. So there's a lot of volcanism. Much of this was subaerial and later sank down into the sea. So when the Atlantic broke open like this, there was some sort of land bridge here. And when it got to a particular width, then things started to sink below the sea. And so now we've just got a block in the middle sticking up. But people were interested to know, I mean, people speculated that this might be continental material and so on, so they were interested to know if these magnetic stripes crossed the ridge. And the person who sorted this all out was Martin Bott, who's an emeritus professor here. He shares the room with me, so some of you have bumped into him. And he's the person who did all the surveying here. And you can also see that there's a sort of a much more irregular pattern here, because this zone opened up like that, and at the same time this zone opened up like this. So there was quite a complicated history of development of this region, and that was all sorted out using magnetics. It's a very interesting question whether the Earth is the only planet in the solar system with plate tectonics. So people have looked at this, and I suppose the balance of opinion is, yes, it is the only planet. But these intriguing data recently appeared. This came up 1 or 2 years ago, I can't remember. And this came from a mission to Mars, which measured the magnetic field in detail, and people saw these reversals here. So it has been suggested that maybe in the past there was plate tectonics on Mars. So I think most people are a little bit sceptical about this. You know, one have to look in detail at the original data to draw one's own conclusion. The way you should draw your own personal scientific opinions is not by saying what is the majority view and going for that, but by taking the trouble to look at the original data and the observations, because you can see from the Vine Matthews story that the majority view was wrong. If everybody had always followed the majority view, we'd never have developed plate tectonics. But, you know, if Earth is the only planet with plate tectonics, then why is that? People have even suggested that maybe life has got something to do with plate tectonics occurring, but can't imagine how that would occur, but you know, it'd be an interesting coincidence, wouldn't it, if the only planet with life was the only planet with plate tectonics. Life obviously changes the environment a lot. California, back to our old friend Long Valley. This is the magnetic map of California. We have the coastal area, the coastal mountain ranges. The Great Valley in the middle here, where a lot of agriculture is done. And then we have the Sierra Nevada mountain range here. Yosemite is over here somewhere. Those of you who have been there. So you can see that there's some kind of very broad relation between magnetics and the very broad geology of the area. All these busy little anomalies here and strong anomalies. These are associated with the Sierra Nevada mountain range, and in the Great Valley here, which is floored with very thick sediments, we don't see all this busyness anomalies. And here we have Long Valley itself. It seems to be associated with a chain of magnetic lows. These are blue areas here. These are low intensity magnetic resurgent dome in the middle, as you know. So we seem to have low magnetization passing under the resurgent dome. Could anybody think why that might be? Why might the material under the resurgent dome have a low magnetic intensity? Yes?
If it's molten, it'd be above the...
Yes, yes. Very good. Well done. You know about the Curie temperature. Materials above about 570-something degrees, then it loses its magnetization, and the magnetization becomes attenuated the hotter the material is. So there might be some evidence here for hot material under the center of the caldera. And conversely, in these regions here, then magnetization is low. Here is a region of commercial interest, an example of commercial interest. So you can see a little bit where this is going. Okay? I'm trying to give you examples that cover a very broad range of possible situations. Other planets, plate tectonics, commercial, tectonic interest, lots of diversity in examples. You know, try to go for that in your essays. So, this is associated with banded iron formations. And, you know, this just smacks out of the page at you, doesn't it? This zone of high magnetization. Your boss said to you, you know, we've just acquired. A friend of mine in America has just spent $10 million on about 20 parcels of land, so-called. You imagine something wrapped in brown paper, don't you? He's acquired the geothermal prospecting rights over about 10 or 20 parcels of land in Nevada. So you just buy these. You don't own the land. You just own the rights. And of course, he's acquired these rights, spent all this money before prospecting them, okay? Because, you know, if there's lots of information out there in the public domain, then other people are going to bid, the price might be higher, you might not get it, so forth. So the thing to do is to have some knowledge of the geology yourself and then go for the important areas and then do detailed prospecting. So, you know, you might, your boss might say to you, we've acquired such and such a parcel, you know, go and see if there might be some iron, worthwhile iron minerals there. So you would immediately do a magnetic survey and you get something like this. And you say, well, you know, this obviously is extremely important. You might have got this by aeromagnetics. You would take a team out there. You would start doing profiles across here. Okay, you wouldn't go to some complicated area here. You'd go out with some geophysicists and some geologists and you'd look at a simple area like that to give you some idea of what the rest might be. And then when you thought you understood things, you would start looking at more complicated regions like this, and you would bear in mind, you know, having found all these valuable iron resources and got an enormous bonus and a promotion in your job, you would then say, well, I happen to know from Professor Folger's lectures in 2008 that there can be valuable resources which do not give a strong magnetic anomaly. So then you might like to get hold of a bunch of geologists to start looking at the rest of the area here and seeing if there were deposits of hematite as well as the magnetic stuff. Okay, depth to basement. Here's a nice example of how this really was very important. So here we have Tasmania. Here we have Australia. I was raised in a little town here, which lived off open cast coal mining. You can tell me how I have an Australian accent. I deny it. Here we have the Gippsland Basin, which is a deep sedimentary basin. This is in thousands of feet. And this contains useful gas resources. So gas here is used to provide necessary energy for major cities along the eastern coast of Australia. So this is a very valuable basin. But then an aeromagnetic survey was done over the whole of this strait here between Tasmania and Australia. It was found that the depth to basement was very great in this basin here. So this was, nothing was known about this. It was blue water. And then they do a magnetic survey and they find that there's another huge sedimentary basin here. Well, I mean, you know, Tasmania must be separated from Australia for some reason or another. And when they prospected that, they found that this had got valuable gas resources in it too. So, you know, a simple aeromagnetic survey, told them where to look. And although, you know, they may have had nothing except this map, wouldn't need necessarily to go much further than that. It would be useful. And here's a good example of an iron ore deposit in Australia, where some of the resources are shown by a whopping big strong anomaly and others aren't. So here we have the resource in general, the shaded area. Here we have the magnetic contours, and you can see there's a very strong high here. And this is associated, these black sausage-like things, these are the mineable resources. These are where the greatest concentrations of iron ore are. This one's called Iron Queen, and it's associated with this enormous high here. There's another one down here. More resources down here. Here's the Iron Warrior. Don't know who came up with these fanciful ideas. Sounds very Tolkienian, doesn't it? But here we've got some stuff up here called the Iron Baron and the Iron Prince, and you can see that there's virtually no magnetic field over those. You know, only geologists would have seen those. Geophysicists could produce this magnetic anomaly and find this one here, but they wouldn't have spotted this one, probably because those iron deposits are in the form of hematite, which has low susceptibility. Kimberlite pipe. Nice big bullseye with an amplitude of about 100 gamma. Here we have the scale. Okay, here we have the little pipe here. So the little pipe is about 300 metres across. Very small, about 500 metres long. So you can imagine that to get these contours here, you know, you'd be taking a magnetic measurement every metre or so. You wouldn't pick this up by aeromagnetic surveying, flying at 1,000 feet. You would have to send a bunch of undergraduates out to spend weeks doing hundreds of points at intervals of a metre. Obviously the rewards would be great. And archaeology, how many people are doing an archaeology module? You're not allowed to, are you, in the second year? How many did one in the first year? Just one person. Gosh. Was it good? No, it wasn't? Okay, we weren't asking. Not a recommendation. Well, what can be done in the field of archaeology is absolutely sort of gobsmacking. I mean, one problem with archaeology is if you dig an area, you've destroyed it. So archaeology is, you know, the investigation is destroying what you're looking at. You dig some area up, but with geophysics, you could just walk across an area with a magnetometer or something like this, and you can, you know, you can produce something like this, which is giving you tremendous detail. I mean, to dig all this, you know, it would just be prohibitively expensive. So the development of geophysical tools that can really do a good job of archaeology, I mean, that's just been, you know, a huge revolution in archaeology. This is completely amazing. If you watch Time Team, okay, and just to finish up on high-res surveys, so this is the latest thing. People have discovered that, although current wisdom would have it, that sedimentary rocks have a low susceptibility and you know, they don't give any magnetic signal, it's been discovered that that's not strictly true, that there is some bacteria living in sedimentary rocks often which excretes magnetite. So these things are metabolizing magnetite. These bacteria are obviously going to live where there's water in fault zones. So fault zones in sedimentary sequences, which of course I'm interested in, if you're interested in hydrocarbons or something like this, those fault zones are going to have a stronger magnetic signal than the rest of the sedimentary sequence. So, but the signal is still quite weak. Now you need to use a very sensitive magnetometer. You need to do a very high spec survey, but you can survey a sedimentary area, and it can help you to pick out fault zones. So this sedge is just giving you some kind of idea. So conventionally, you know, your average bog standard magnetic survey might have a line spacing of 7 kilometres, tie spacing of 10 lines, precision and so on and so forth. You have to just divide all that by 10 for these high-res surveys. You have to have a line spacing of less than 1 kilometre, so you're in this little aeroplane flying at 80 metres, so only war heroes need to fly, only people who, you know, death is no barrier. So flying along at 80 metres at 1 kilometre. Your navigation has to be super accurate. Well, there's no problem with GPS nowadays. You have to have a super low noise recording system, very high precision magnetometer. So obviously you're not going to go out with a flux gate or a proton precession magnetometer if you want this sort of precision. You've got to have an optical pumping device or something like that. So we're in a brave new world, flying at 80 metres and hedgehopping. Processing, very sophisticated. And such survey has been applied to an area in Dixie Valley. This is a geothermal area. I may be working on this myself over this coming summer, I don't know yet. Lots of geothermal in Nevada. Nevada's got all these faults, grabens, many of them have geothermal areas in them. And this is what it looked like. It's seismically active. Bunch of magnitude 7 earthquakes in 1954, producing these huge fault scarps here. There's a very famous picture of a cabin where some old prospector lived out in the desert, and his outhouse, you know, the toilet associated with this cabin was the other side of the fault, so his cabin ended up down here, and the toilet was up here after the earthquake. I should fish that photograph out. This is a geothermal plant, which is currently in operation out there. Imagine it's people actually work at these places and live in the middle of the desert out there. One-horse towns. We've got a gas station. So this was the area of interest that was surveyed, Dixie Valley. Hot springs, salt marsh. Very detailed aeromag was flown over that. Specifications in your own time. Observation height above ground, 120 metres. So you can imagine this little aeroplane is flying. Now that's not very far above the top of the cooling towers. See safety issues involved. So these are the results after the first basic processing. The red is strong magnetisation, the blue is low, so there are obviously some features here where the magnetic field is strong. Here we have the hot springs, seem to be associated with a low, which maybe you would expect that. That's a upwelling. So obviously what's being looked for here is heat. Heat and also fault lines. Heat is obviously necessary to get the resource out of the ground, but fault lines are aquifers. So what these guys are trying to do, they're trying to drill into permeability. It's no use just drilling into hot rock. You've got to drill somewhere through a fault zone or in a permeable area where fluids can be drawn up your borehole. So they did lots of things with this. They calculated, they reduced the data to the pole, so that's what it looks like. It's a whole lot different. Looks as though there's some sort of moat here, separating this feature here from this feature here. Shaded relief image of the horizontal gradients. Again, you can see that there's some sort of feature here, and there's some sort of feature here. So, you know, and you may be looking at structure. There are fault zones bounding this area, and what you're looking for is more fault zones. So on the left we have short wavelength component, medium wavelength component, and then long wavelength component. So they've looked at the spectrum of the data, and they've picked out the signals that might be due to large-scale bodies. small scale bodies. So again, we see this feature here and this feature here. So these look as though they're going north-south. And this is the interpretation. People worked on this, they compared it with geological information.